I wanted to ask you about that, actually. Do you think that's what started the harassment that happened to him on the base after that?
I'm pretty sure that had a lot to do with it. He identified himself that very first day as a potential troublemaker, and he is a very interesting guy in that sometimes, you know, curiosity overwhelms fear. Or in the case of classic whistleblowers, and he is one, and the Karen Silkwood model, perceiving that something has been done absolutely wrong or unethically or inappropriately or in some way that, you know, the man is on your case, you'll go against it even at the risk of your life and even though it may make your life miserable. And Larry is that kind of guy. So he then reconnects with the operator and, you know, goes into a huff. I was just cut off on a transatlantic call. And this is a regular, you know, British telephone personnel. And she says, sir, are you calling from the base? And he says, yes. And she says, well, then you were cut off from within the base. And as I recall, he hangs up the phone, looks at Greg, and says, I'm fucked. And they walk back to the billet, and he sits in his room and basically waits for somebody to get on his case. It's not long before he is called down to the base law enforcement office. And there's an officer there who says, you know, Airman, you were told not to discuss this, and yet you made a call this morning and did just that. And Larry looked him in the eyes and absolutely untruthfully said, no, sir, I did not. And the officer said, yes, you did. Larry said, I did not. The officer opens the lower drawer of his desk where there's a big old reel-to-reel tape recorder, and he plays in the conversation. And then, without making a big scene or anything, says, I know you're under a lot of stress. What you saw is very upsetting and unusual, and, you know, I'm not going to throw the book at you, but I can't just let this go, so... you have a choice. We'll either bust you a rank or, you know, fine you a certain amount of money and take it out of your pay in increments. And Larry felt it would take him years to get back to that rank, or a long time anyway, and so he took the penalty, the financial penalty. And interestingly, it was, I don't know, a couple $100, but whatever it was, when he left the service, he still had like 95 bucks in change that was had not been paid, and that came back in kind of an interesting way later. Later that day, he and other men were debriefed, and you remember the debriefing is rather dramatic. For the record, they were not debriefed by any Air Force personnel at all. There were three men. Two of them were in suits, and doing our homework later, we learned that they were with the field arm of the National Security Agency. The military individual was a naval intelligence officer. And Navy intelligence threads its way through the entire history of the UFO cover-up. We are convinced that these men, and these were all about the same rank, men that Larry had been out in the field with the night before primarily, were told what we would call disinformation. And disinformation is a very specific term, and it means a mixture of actual, factual, real information and completely false, invented information that has been put together to produce a certain purpose. In this case, maybe to intimidate, to overwhelm, to upset, to confuse, whatever. But they were told certain things. Whether or not they were true, I have no idea, but among the things they were told is that what they had seen the night before was, in fact, representative of another intelligence, possessing advanced technology, not of this earth, that had been coming and going with impunity since, quote-unquote, or close on, longer than you boys have been alive. And that we, you know, the Air Force, the military, the Western world, whatever you want to put there, have been trying to work out a way to go public with this information. It was still probably a long way off, and until then, you are not to talk about this. You are now essentially part of the national security apparatus of America and the Western world. And that if you were to violate this, you would be in some pretty deep shit. The men were told that their security clearances had been upped. That was not a promotion. That was a way of prosecuting them at a higher level if they did break security. And they were shown a series of films, all spliced together, most of which were wing camera footage from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, all including UFO footage in context. And the last piece of footage was shot on the moon, or was filmed to suggest that it was shot on the moon, of seeing an astronaut and UFOs as well. When it was over, they were told they could leave. A question was asked, I believe, by Larry, what happens if, you know, we do talk about this. And one of the guys, one of the NSA guys, again, field arm of the NSA, said with not quite a smile, but, you know, was he serious? Who knows? He was, he said to the men there, quote unquote, bullets are cheap. I should stress here that I have had that quote confirmed to me by 3, 4, 5 men that were in the room. So it's not just an invented phrase. One of the men in the room was under particular stress. He was a southerner. I think his nickname was Alabama. He went into that debriefing with a Bible, and Larry said he was kind of, you could hear him through most of the thing. It sounded at first like a hum or a mantra, and realized he's probably praying to himself. But this enters into the story in that not long afterwards, this man went AWOL, was met, I think, when he landed in Chicago by FBI, who put him right on the next plane. He was returned to the base, returned to active service, to the best of our knowledge, not given any counseling, given a loaded weapon, and blew his brains out on the tarmac not long after, after reporting and he couldn't take it anymore, and Larry and the other man he was with were the first to find him.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say, and Larry will back me up on this, that this is really what radicalized and galvanized him. Sure, he was curious. Yes, he had a previous non-standard experiences in life, at least one with his mom, but this man was now dead. And that is sort of the sweep of the 3 days.
Wow, yeah, that's...
But as you know, it brings us to an almost more compelling or equally compelling part of the story, which is that that fourth night, the night after the incident, the evening of that day that they had the debriefing, Larry, Adrian, other men were told that the debriefing would continue and to, in Larry's case, be out in front of his billet, his barracks at 8 o'clock at night to meet with and continue answering questions or whatever. A late model black American vehicle pulled up. There were two men in suits. Guy got out of the driver's side. Are you Warren? Yes. Can I see some ID? Larry being Larry basically said to the guy, let me see some of your ID. The guy did not like that. And at this point, Larry's memories were for years a bit spotty. He had a conscious memory, but it would drop off and come back. And it was not until the 1990s when he did a regressive hypnosis session with Bud Hopkins that the transcript is included in the book, and I witnessed the session. I've witnessed many regressive hypnoses. I never saw one like this. He was a kid again and going through this, and at that point, when that man gets out of the car, the other man comes around the side, raises his hand, and Larry is sprayed with an aerosol container and goes down. Temporarily blinded, his nose is running, he's having trouble breathing. He does not have real control of his motor functions. He's thrown in the back seat. And at that point, he disappears for a day and a half. Men who ask are told he's on, quote-unquote, emergency leave. He is taken to a huge holding area in a facility below the Twin Base complex, where he and others are subjected to programming, to mentally destabilizing techniques, to setting up a scenario where they are led to believe that this area is manned by humans and non-humans, which I feel is an invention, that this was, you know, they were mentally manipulated.
Yeah.
And he is released before New Year's and makes it his business, as well as he can, to try to put the stories together of some of the other men. Of course, this is all now extremely on the quiet. Sometime later, he is put on sort of stenography, office work kind of thing, and is caught going through a filing cabinet that he's not authorized to. He's obsessed. He wants to know what happened.
Yeah.
Ultimately, he receives his honorable discharge and leaves the service in full-blown post-traumatic stress. And it's not until 1982, he leaves the year before, that he goes to a police UFO investigator who, interestingly, was at least an acquaintance of Pete Mazzola, who is one of my mentors, who is a police lieutenant in Coventry, Connecticut, and a UFO investigator, Larry Fawcett, who's co-author of a UFO classic called Clear Intent, written in the 70s. And Larry Warren gives Fawcett and his small team of investigators, including a legally trained individual who institutes a Freedom of Information Act action, using only information, location, names, dates, times, etc., that Warren has given him. And that results the following year in the result of the so-called HALT memo, the one-page report, which is sort of a compression of the three nights into one incident that the deputy base commander wrote up several weeks after the fact. And that sits quietly for the next years until it is released. A copy is, as a courtesy, sent to British investigators who get the story to a national tabloid, and the story explodes as a news story in October of 83, with Larry having been assigned a pseudonym. And that's the point where the story becomes public knowledge. So that is basically the three nights plus of the actual event, but as you know, the book itself sweeps across decades.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, focuses on the long-term investigation and the impact this has on the individual. So that sort of brings us up to the moment.
Okay. Wow, that was detailed, but it was amazing. It was like, you're not going to get a better recount of the Bentwater story than that. So, all right, let me take a look at what I got here. Well, it seems like when Larry first decides to come forward, he's sort of caught. There's some dueling researchers. There's a lot of turf wars going on.
Well, you're right.
The UK researchers and Larry Fawcett.
Yeah.
And the people that he's working with.
Yeah.
How does Larry deal with that? Sort of being caught in the middle of that.
As he said, like a trained monkey, he didn't know what to do. He just wanted to get the story out. But it's a sad fact of human nature that even when you are an advocate for a cause, you sometimes depersonalize people and you see them as cases or, you know, pieces of a puzzle. And it's something I have trained myself to never do. These are human beings, and many of them in fairly delicate circumstances after life-changing and shattering events. So he is manipulated and jerked around a bit, ultimately kind of, you know, becomes his own person on this and goes forward, being an in-your-face kind of guy and not backing down from the story. And a thing which was used to suggest that he was not telling the truth, when he first came forward, he did not dare tell the whole thing. And it was not until later that he did. He also did something with me, which at the time, had he not done it, I would have walked away because I would not have wanted to get involved in it. He, in the case of Adrian, who had a similar experience to his, stood next to him. Adrian was not interested in going forward directly, but was encouraging to Larry to do it and said, you can take part of my experience and say it's yours. It's not really a lie because it happened to me. And so that combination of this happened to me and then saying, but more happened to me several years later, and that a guy I know, could have been me, or it happened to me, but it really happened to a guy I know.
Yeah.
Combined with his very he's just a tough character, and you know, he's not stakes out a position and he holds it, and he'll get in your face and in a rage. So he was branded a controversial witness, and I guess he was in that sense. He's a very courageous witness, but nobody else had wanted to come forward. And indeed, he was not one of the first guys to come forward. He was the first, and now there are quite a number who have come forward. And in the updated version of Left at Eastgate, which I'm pleased to say will be out in December, we have statements from other men who were involved backing up our characterizations of them in the book and adding more to the picture of what they knew.
Oh, nice.
And very exciting. I'm very proud of that part. We've got quite a group of contributors for the revised version. He then became his own person. I had heard about this, I guess, in early 84. Again, the case had broken publicly in 83 in Britain, but by 84, early 84, most of us that were into this in the States had heard about this so-called UFO event in Great Britain. But it wasn't until 84 that we actually ran into each other several years before we really connected. This would have been at the in Westchester at a town meeting where the there were tremendous UFO flights over Westchester, New York, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of, well, probably thousands of people saw it, but hundreds were willing to come forward, regular citizens. And we met for quite a lengthy series of discussions and statements explanations, or at least encouragements of people coming forward on this, in high school in Westchester. And at a break, I went outside for a cigarette, and there was a kind of a knot of people, and made my way up to it with my friends, and in the middle was this guy who we had heard about, telling part of his story, and I waded in and heard him out, and you know, kind of was part of one of those people that, you know, shook his hand, said thank you, and I thought he was pretty courageous. I also thought, you know, if he was a liar, he was the best. It seemed absolutely sincere. But I also thought he must be a bit naive, because, you know, what happens to people that do this? This is pretty reckless. You're just coming forward and saying, yeah, when I was in the military, and on and on.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until 87, though, that we really met and connected at a conference in Washington, where we heard each other speak and kind of, you know, buttonholed each other the next day in the hallway and, you know, chatted and made a decision to continue our talk, and things went on from there.
Now, at some point when he first came forward, he used the alias Ard Wallace.
That was a alias that Larry Fawcett assigned him, and Larry said, you know, we want to protect your, you know, security here and your privacy, which I'm sure was true, but it was also a very theatrical device that made it sound much more undercover and cloak and daggery, and Larry Warren was never very comfortable with this, but for the initial first months and into 84, he was, you know, speaking under the name of Ard Wallace, and then dumped it, and since then has never spoken under any name but his own.
Yeah, when did he drop it? Because in the book it's sort of like...
We don't say when that happened. You know what? I think it was in later 84. But you know what? Yeah, I'm as sure as I can be it was in 84. If not, it would have had to have been shortly after. Certainly by the time we met in 87, he was fully under his own name. But I think it was 84. It didn't last long.
And then, like you said, it came out in the U.S. a little bit. There was a couple of TV segments on it, right? CNN and Unsolved Mysteries.
Well, CNN, which actually was born in 1984, Ted Turner, who's quite a guy, developed an interest in this case and made the incident the subject of a series of CNN's very first special reports. And I know through Chuck DeCaro, who at the time was CNN's military and technology reporter and former Green Beret, military background, tough guy, great reporter, that he was the chief investigator assigned to the case, and that he had been authorized to spend over $200,000 of Ted Turner's money, plenty of money now, but even more then. They hit the wall with the Air Force. He had plenty of contacts within defense and within the military. Used them all. I think at one point CNN had prepared a list of 20 questions that they submitted to the Air Force. The Air Force answered them, sent them back, and they caught them in either, I don't know, either 15, 16, or 17 lies out of the 20.
Wow.
Chuck ultimately lost his job in part because of pushing a little too hard, and it was some years before he kind of came back into the field. I spent time with him as well, and there's a wonderful interview with Chuck Inleft at Eastgate. But that was in 84. It was some years later, I'm trying to remember when, maybe 87 or so, that Unsolved Mysteries did a segment on Bent Waters, and it was the first of what is now many, many television treatments or partial treatments here and in the UK as well as in other countries. The most recent known one, let's see, there's I think two or so that date from the UK in the last couple of years. They just keep popping up.
Oh, yeah.
And in 2002, the Sci-Fi Channel did an outstanding one that's without commercials, 90 minutes.
Oh, wow.
That will be shown again in rotation in December on the channel. And I can tell you now, and this is sort of, you got a scoop here because the word isn't out on it, that a documentary house called Towers Productions in Chicago was commissioned some months ago by the Sci-Fi Channel, no, I'm sorry, by the History Channel to do a brand new one-hour documentary. And I've just completed working as a consultant on that and helped set them up with different witnesses and information and documents and things. Larry was filmed again on location in Suffolk last month. I was interviewed in New York. And I'm very proud to say that the History Channel will be broadcasting that in December for the first time.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. But there have been an awful lot of treatments on it and partial treatments, some of them as good as they could, other ones that were just screwy and goofy and almost insulting, other ones that were extremely uneven, and that's the nature of the beast.
Yeah. All right, sort of a two-part question, I guess. First, let's Adrian Bastenza, he's really only featured in anecdotes and in that one transcript. Did you talk to him while you were making the book at all, or since, or have you been in contact with him, or is he pretty much in, like, not into this?
Adrian's an interesting case. Early on, I spoke to John Burroughs, who was involved in the first night, spoke to other witnesses. Adrian made it clear through channels that he was not interested in adding to what he had already said, but since then, and this would have been in the later 80s, but since then, he has been more forthcoming. And part of Adrian's hesitancy, from what I understand with all due respect, is that he has worked in border patrol position, in enforcement, in a government job for quite a number of years. Also, his family was very upset that he had gone through this, and he's not interested in causing them any more emotional distress. There is some new information from him in the Sci-Fi documentary, and there is some added information on him confirming aspects of this, including the machine in the field and being with Larry and all that, as well as a letter that he wrote to Larry, which I quote from in the updated and revised version of Left at Eastgate that
will
be out late this year.
Awesome.
Yeah. So we do have some more information from him.
All right. And now what about Larry Fawcett? Because he's kind of a big part of the beginning of the book when he sort of is Larry Warren's conduit into the UFO field. But then he sort of drops off. And I've only really been in the field now for like the last 3, 4, 5 years or so. Yeah. I haven't heard much about him. Has Larry Fawcett dropped out of the UFO field, or is he still active doing research?
Well, that's a good question, Tim. He retired from the Coventry Police Department quite a number of years ago, moved out of Connecticut, moved down to Florida. I've been in touch with him not in several years, but we were back and forth fairly cordially, on and off irregularly. And if he's still investigating, he's doing it as a private citizen, and he's a retired guy living in Florida. But he's certainly still out there. I am not aware of, you know, him being active in the UFO field, but to the best of my knowledge, he is alive and well and very likely approachable somewhere in Florida.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, so Larry, that's pretty much the backstory here. Now, Larry comes to you, and this is when you sort of become a part of the book. Mm. He comes to you to write the book, and you said you'd heard about the case before, and you knew who Larry Warren was. Mm. What did you think? Were you like, oh my, this is unbelievable. This guy, you know, he was there, and now he wants to write the book. Like, what were you thinking when he asked you to write the book?
That's a great question. I was thinking a bunch of things. Again, I heard him speak in Washington and realized this was the guy I had, you know, met on the front lawn of that high school in Westchester, New York, 4 years earlier, and he was very passionate. He was cut off also at this conference. The excuse was other speakers had run too long, so that had to chop the time out of his. And Larry has no love for many people in the UFO research community because he feels that they're even more duplicitous than skeptics because they, you know, say that they're on the side of the witness, but in fact, you know, they use you and dump you and often distort what you've said. So his back was up. We both had different motives. When I approached him, he approached me in the hallway that next day on Sunday in Washington, and we were at American University there, 40th anniversary of the UFO Phenomena Conference, 1987 MUFON. His angle was, I don't believe in false modesty. I'm a good speaker, and I was good then. And he said to himself, that's the guy I want to write the book with. I'm not exactly sure why still, but that was his judgment call. When I heard him speak, I was really clear that I wanted to do a really extended interview with this guy and would do what I had to get it. Authentic military witnesses, and now convinced beyond any doubt Larry is at the time, I was quite convinced, are very rare. The guys that come forward and say, I want you all to know I'm speaking at the risk of my life, and, you know, I've had, you know, all these things happen to me, and these guys try to... Often there's a lot of hot air there. But he seemed like the goods, and I suggested that we get together again and that he let me do an interview. And he said, how about next weekend? I said, sure. And he's married at the time. Came down from Connecticut, slept on my couch. I had that recorder going for, Christ, I think 6 hours over the weekend. It was an amazing interview, Tim. And he was answering most of my questions. On other things, he would simply veer off and not answer it. On other things, he chose not to, but he was very forthcoming on almost everything. And some of the things, I had done some homework on the case, was had never gone into print. And I was thinking to myself, gosh, this is great. I've got a potential for a good article here that I can sell, and I'm breaking some new information. And what's this guy's angle? You know, he's not asking me for anything. I mean, he made it very clear at the start that whatever I, you know, wrote down that we, you know, drew from my taped interviews, I was free to use. He didn't want any money or anything. And toward the end of the weekend, late that Sunday afternoon, I put him on the spot and said, what's really going on here? Why are you telling me all this and giving me this information? And he said, because I've wanted to write a book on this. I've been toying with it for several years, but I'm not a writer. I realize I need somebody else to do this with. And my first question was, well, why don't you get a writer? You know, I'm not really either. I've got a couple articles out, and I'm an investigator. You know, I'm serious. But he said, no, I think it's you, and I think part of the reason is because you can really feel what I'm going through, because what I was speaking on, I was on a panel discussion with, among other people, Whitley Strieber, who had just come forward as a public figure, who had abduction experiences was one of my sisters had grown up with abduction experiences, and that is what got me into this work, nothing else, and the sighting that we had had as kids. And he said, you know, I know this is, you know, woven into your family life, and, you know, you're serious about it, and you're not going to lie, and I think you're the guy. And here's my offer. If you will write a book with me and let me say in my words my experience as I know it and, you know, put myself on the record, I will open my life to you completely. You will have full carte blanche of every bit of paperwork on me. You can talk to my mom, you know, here's my high school report card. I'll give you everything I have on this, all my military records that I have, although I don't have many. Most of them are being held by the National Security Agency since 81, which is true, even the most innocuous. And if you can prove me a liar, do it. And it might be a weird kind of schizophrenic book if we go that route, but if you write this with me, we're 50% partners on everything that happens, and, you know, that's how I feel. And I thought to myself, this is not the kind of offer that somebody makes if they have something to hide.
Yeah.
And I was looking, frankly, for a serious writing project. I had done my share of articles at that point. I really was ready to get my teeth into something more. I had trained myself to be a pretty good investigative writer at that point. But I have to tell you, Tim, and I say it in the book, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I thought, frankly, okay, this is cool. I'll work a year or so, you know, we'll spend a couple of $1,000s, we'll publish a book, we'll be rich and famous, get some girlfriends, and this will be wonderful.
Yeah.
The fact is that it was nothing like that. Between us, I think we returned to, then shortly after he suggested that we go back to England, I thought, wow, go to England too. That's totally cool.
Yeah, yeah.
He even offered to pick up the airfare, and I thought, well, that's over the top. And, you know, some months later we did do that after I'd done a lot of armchair research over the preceding months. But that's what I thought I was in for, and instead I was in for something that ate up almost a decade of my life, shattered a lot of my peace of mind and security. Bankrupted Larry, essentially bankrupted me. We spent between us over $100,000,
oh, wow.
Vaporized our savings. I think we returned to England between us working on the book 15 times.
Whew.
It was madness, and that obsession bug bit me, especially with the wrongs that had been done to these men and the impact on their lives. It weighed on me at least equally as much as, you know, my fascination with these other intelligences and what's the real truth here. But that was what got me going. And again, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I'll say it right now, had I known what I was getting myself into, you would not have been reading that book, because I wouldn't have written it.
Really?
Yep, I would not have written it.
Wow.
I mean, I'm real proud that I did now. And in many ways, it's opened my life in some wonderful ways, but met terrific people. I've had an opportunity to travel a lot more than I had previously, and had some wonderful adventures and things. But it scared the crap out of me. I was working with somebody who was really, really the angriest person I've ever met in my life, who was full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder for some of that time, and not a pleasant person to be around at all. But I never took it personally, and, you know, even Larry, at his most difficult, I was able to see past that and understand that this was a guy who had been very badly hurt and lied to and abused, so to say, and that something had happened to him when he was in the service that he was completely obsessed with, and there was no question about that. And what he wanted was answers, and I ultimately was the guy that helped him figure out some of the answers.
That does it for this week's edition of Banal of America Audio, Season 1. Thanks to Peter Robbins for stopping by. You can find contact information for Peter at banalofamerica.com. And, of course, you can find a host of other audio interviews and fantastic esoteric tidbits at banalofamerica.com, www.binallofamerica.com. I want to thank Leslie and Chiron of banalofamerica.com for your continued support and help with the audio series. And, of course, I want to thank all the listeners out there who have been downloading and now streaming and listening to Banal of America Audio Season 1 and our predecessor, Banal of America Audio, the X-Conference Sessions. If you haven't got a chance to stop by banalofamerica.com and listen to those, I highly suggest you check them out. Next week, part 2 of 2 with Peter Robbins. We're going to talk even more extensively on Left at Eastgate, plus discussion on Peter's trip to Japan and what Japanese ufology is like. Also a little bit on Chinese ufology, some on the women in ufology, and a lengthy discussion on the internet and ufology, as Peter has seen the evolution of ufology on the internet and can give us his take on what that was like. So all that and tons more next week on Banal of America Audio Season 1, plus we'll have some names released for future editions of Banal of America Audio. I hope you stop by and check it out. I hope you enjoyed this week's interview, and until you hear from me next week, ladies and gentlemen, this is Tim Banal saying so long.